Side 10. All this I learned later, of course. Colin Mackenzie, who was through it all, said it was pathetic to see how old Elfish shilly-shallied and changed his mind, and McNaughton still refused to believe that disaster was approaching. What had begun as mob violence was rapidly developing into a general uprising, and all that was wanting on the Afghan side was a leader who would take charge of events. And, of course, unknown to Elfie and McNaughton and the rest of them, there was such a leader, watching events from a house in Kabul, biding his time, and every now and then asking me questions. For after a fortnight's lapse, Akbar Khan came to me again, polite and bland as ever, and talked about and about, speculating on such various matters as British policy in India and the rate of march of British troops in cold weather. He came ostensibly to gossip, but he pumped me for all he was worth. And I let him pump. There was nothing else I could do. He began visiting me daily, and I got tired of demanding my release and having my questions deftly ignored. But there was no help for it. I could only be patient and see what this jovial, clever gentleman had in mind for me. Of what he had in mind for himself, I was getting a pretty fair idea, and events proved me right. Finally, more than a month after Burns's murder, Akbar came and told me I was to be released. I could have kissed him almost, for I was fed up with being jailed and not even an Afghan bint to keep me amused. He looked mighty serious, however, and asked me to be seated while he spoke to me on behalf of the leaders of the faithful. He had three of his pals with him, and I wondered if he meant them. One of them, his cousin, Sultan Jan, he had brought before, a leery-looking cove with a forked beard. The others were called Mohammed Din, a fine-looking old lad with a silver beard, and Khan Hamet, a one-eyed thug with the face of a horse thief. They sat and looked at me, and Akbar talked. "First, my dear friend Flashman," says he, all charm, "I must tell you that you have been kept here not only for your own good, but for your people's. Their situation is now bad. Why, I do not know, but Elfistan Saab has behaved like a weak old woman. He has allowed the mobs to rage where they will. He has left the deaths of his servants unavenged. He has exposed his soldiers to the worst fate of all, humiliation, by keeping them shut up in cantonments while the Afghan rabble mock at them. Now his own troops are sick at heart. They have no fight in them." He paused, picking his words. "The British cannot stay here now," he went on. "They have lost their power, and we Afghans wish to be rid of them. There are those who say we should slaughter them all. Needless to say, I do not agree." And he smiled. "For one thing, it might not be so easy."
"It is never easy," said old Mohammed Din. "These same Ferengis to Ghuzni fought. I saw them, by God."
"And for another, what would the harvest be?" went on Akbar. "The White Queen avenges her children. No, there must be a peaceful withdrawal to India. That is what I would prefer myself. I am no enemy of the British, but they have been guests in my country too long." "One of them a month too long," says I, and he laughed. "You are one Ferengi fleshman who is welcome to stay as long as he chooses," says he. "But for the rest, they have to go." "They came to put Suja on the throne," says I. "They won't leave him in the lurch."
"They have already agreed to do so," said Akbar smoothly. "Myself, I have arranged the terms of withdrawal with McLaughton Saab."
"You've seen McNaughton?"
"Indeed. The British have agreed with me and the chiefs to march out to Peshawar as soon as they have gathered provisions for the journey and struck their camp. Suja, it is agreed, remains on the throne, and the British are guaranteed safe conduct through the passes."
So we were quitting Kabul. I didn't mind, but I wondered how Elfie and McNaughton were going to explain this away to Calcutta. Inglorious retreat, pushed out by niggers, don't look well at all. Of course, the bit about Suja staying on the throne was all my eye. Once we were out of the way, they'd blind him quietly and pop him in a fortress and forget about him. And the man who would take his place was sitting watching how I took the news. "Well," says I at last, "there it is, but what have I to do with it? I mean, I'll just toddle off for the rest, won't I?" Akbar leaned forward.
"I have made it sound too simple, perhaps. There are problems. For example, McLaughton has made his treaty to withdraw not only with myself, but with the Duranis, the Gilzais, the Kuzilbashis, and so on, all as equals. Now, when the British have gone, all these factions will be left behind. And who will be the master? Shah Shuja, according to you. He can rule only if he has a united majority of the tribes supporting him. As things stand, that would be difficult for they eye each other askance. Oh, McLawton Saab is not the fool you think him. He has been at work to divide us. Well, can't you unite them? You're Dost Muhammad's son, ain't you? And all through the passes a month ago, I heard nothing but Akbar Khan and what a hell of a fellow he was. He laughed and clapped his hands. How gratifying. Oh, I have a following, it is true. You have all Afghanistan, growled Sultan Jan. As for Shuja, I have what I have. Akbar interrupted him, suddenly chilly. It is not enough. If I am to support Shuja, as he must be supported. There was a moment of silence, not very comfortable, and Akbar went on. The Duranis dislike me, and they are powerful. It would be better if their wings were clipped, theirs and a few others. This cannot be done after the British have left. With British help, it can be done in time. Oh, ho, oh, I thought, now we have it. What I propose is this, says Akbar, looking me in the eye. McLawton must break his treaty as far as the Duranis are concerned. He must assist me in their overthrow. In return for this, I will allow him, for with the Duranis and their allies gone, I shall have the power to stay in Kabul another 8 months. In that time I shall become Suja's vizier, the power at his elbow. The country will be so quiet then, so quiet that the cheep of a Kandahar mouse will be heard in Kabul, that the British will be able to withdraw in honor. Is not this fair? The alternative now is a hurried withdrawal, which no one here can guarantee in safety, for none has the power to restrain the wilder tribes, and Afghanistan will be left to warring factions. I have observed in the course of a dishonest life that when a rogue is outlining a treacherous plan, he works harder to convince himself than to move his hearers. Akbar wanted to cook his Afghan enemy's goose, that was all, and perfectly understandable, but he wanted to look like a gentleman still, to himself. "Will you carry my proposal secretly to McLawton, Saab, Flashman?" he asked. "If he'd asked me to carry his proposal of marriage to Queen Victoria, I'd have agreed, so, of course, I said aye at once. You may add that, as part of the bargain, I shall expect a down payment of 20 lakhs of rupees," he added, "and 4,000 a year for life. I think McLawton Saab will find this reasonable, since I am probably preserving his political career. And your own, too, thinks I. Shuja's vizier, indeed. Once the Duranis were out of the way, it would be farewell Shuja, and long live King Akbar. Not that I minded. After all, I would be able to say that I was on nodding terms with a king, even if he was only a king of Afghanistan. Now, went on Akbar, you must deliver my proposals to McLawton Saab personally, and in the presence of Mohammed Din and Khan Hamid here, who will accompany you. If it seems, he flashed his smile, that I don't trust you, my friend, let me say that I trust no one. The reflection is not personal.
The wise son, croaked Khan Hamid, opening his mouth for the first time, mistrusts his mother.
Doubtless he knew his own family best.
I pointed out that the plan might appear to McNaughton to be a betrayal of the other chiefs, and his own part in it dishonourable. Akbar nodded and said gently, I have spoken with McLawton Saab, remember. He is a politician. He seemed to think that was answer enough, so I let it be. Then Akbar said, you will tell McLawton that if he agrees, as I think he will, he must come to meet me at Mohammed's fort beyond the cantonment walls the day after tomorrow. He must have a strong force at hand within the cantonment, ready to emerge at the word and seize the Duranis and their allies, who will be with me. Thereafter we will dispose matters as seems best to us. Is this agreed? And he looked at his three fellows, who nodded agreement.
Tell McLawton, Saab, said Sultan Jan with a nasty grin, that if he wills he may have the head of Amanullah Khan, who led the attack on Secunder Burns's residency. Also, that in this whole matter, we of the Beruksis have the friendship of the Gilzais.
If both Gilzais and Beruksis were in the plot, it seemed to me that Akbar was on solid ground. McNaughton would think so, too. But to me, sitting looking at those four faces, bland Akbar and his trio of villains, the whole thing stank like a dead camel. I would have trusted the parcel of them as much as Gulshar's snakes. However, I kept a straight face, and that afternoon the guard at the cantonment's main gate was amazed by the sight of Lieutenant Flashman, clad in the mail of a Baruksi warrior and accompanied by Mohammed Din and Khan Hammett, riding down in state from Kabul City. They'd thought me dead a month ago, chopped to bits with burns, but here I was, larger than life. The word spread like fire, and when we reached the gates there was a crowd waiting for us, with tall Colin Mackenzie at their head. "Where the devil have you come from?" he demanded, his blue eyes wide open. I leaned down so that no one else should hear, and said, "Akbar Khan." He stared at me hard to see if I was mad or joking, and then said, "Come to the envoy at once," and cleared a way through the crowd for us. There was a great hubbub and shouting of questions, but Mackenzie shepherded us all three straight to the envoy's quarters and into Macnaughton's presence.
"Can't it wait, Mackenzie?" says he peevishly. "I'm just about to dine."
But a dozen words from Mackenzie changed his tune. He stared at me through his spectacles, perched as always on the very tip of his nose.
"My God, Flashman, alive! And from Akbar Khan, you say? And who are these?"
"Once you suggested I should bring you hostages from Akbar, Sir William," said I. "Well, here they are, if you like." He didn't take it well, but snapped at me to come in directly to dinner with him. The two Afghans, of course, wouldn't eat at an unbeliever's table, so they waited in his office where food was brought to them. Mohammed Din reminded me that Akbar's message must be delivered only in their presence, so I contented myself by telling Macnaughton that I felt as though I was loaded with explosives, but that it must wait till after dinner. However, as we ate, I was able to give him an account of Burns's murder and my own adventures with Gul Shah. I told it very plain and offhand, but Macnaughton kept exclaiming, "Good God!" all the way through, and at the tail of my tug-of-war, his glasses fell into his curry. Mackenzie sat watching me narrowly, pulling at his fair moustache, and when I was done and Macnaughton was spluttering his astonishment, Mackenzie just said, "Good work, Flash." This was praise from him, for he was a tough, cold ramrod of a man, and reckoned the bravest in the Kabul garrison, except maybe for George Broadfoot. If he told my tale, and he would, Flash's stock would rise to new heights, which was all to the good. Over the port, Macnaughton tried to draw me about Akbar, but I said it must wait until we joined the two Afghans. Not that I minded much, but it made Macnaughton sniffy, which was always excuse enough for me. He said sarcastically that I seemed to have gone native altogether, and that I did not need to be so nice, but Mackenzie said shortly that I was right, which put His Excellency into the sulks. He muttered that it was a fine thing when important officials could be bearded by military whippersnappers, and the sooner we got to business, the better it would be. So we adjourned to his study, and presently Mohammed and Hamid came in, greeted the envoy courteously, and received his cool nod in reply. He was a conceited prig, sure enough. Then I launched into Akbar's proposal. I can see them still. Macnaughton sitting back in his cane chair, legs crossed, fingertips together, staring at the ceiling, the two silent Afghans, their eyes fixed on him, and the tall, fair Mackenzie, leaning against the wall, puffing a cheroot, watching the Afghans. No one said a word as I talked, and no one moved. I wondered if Macnaughton understood what I was saying. He never twitched a muscle. When I was finished, he waited a full minute, slowly took off his glasses and polished them, and said quietly,
"Most interesting. We must consider what the Sardar Akbar has said. His message is of the greatest weight and importance, but, of course, it is not to be answered in haste. Only one thing will I say now. The Queen's envoy cannot consider the suggestion of bloodshed contained in the offer of the head of Amanullah Khan. That is repugnant to me." He turned to the two Afghans. "You will be tired, sirs, so we will detain you no longer. Tomorrow we will talk again."
It was still only early evening, so he was talking rot, but the two Afghans seemed to understand diplomatic language. They bowed gravely and withdrew. Macnaughton watched the door close on them. Then he sprang to his feet.
"Saved at the 11th hour," cried he. "Divide and conquer. Mackenzie, I had dreamed of something precisely like this."
His pale, worn face was all smiles now.
I knew that these people were incapable of keeping faith with one another. Behold me proved right."
Mackenzie studied his cigar. "You mean you'll accept?"
Accept? Of course I shall accept. This is a heaven-sent opportunity. 8 months, eh? Much can happen in that time. We may never leave Afghanistan at all, but if we do, it will be with credit. He rubbed his hands and set to among the papers on his desk. This should revive even our friend Elphinstone. Eh, Mackenzie?
I don't like it, says Mackenzie. I think it's a plot.
Macnaghten stopped to stare at him. A plot? Then he laughed short and sharp. Oh, a plot! Let me alone for that. Trust me for that.
I don't like it a bit, says Mackenzie.
And why not, pray? Tell me, why not? Isn't it logical? Akbar must be cock of the walk, so out must go his enemies, the Turanis. He'll use us, to be sure, but it is to our own advantage.
There's a hole in it, says Mac. He'll never serve as vizier to Sujah. He's lying in that, at least.
What of it? I tell you, Mackenzie, it doesn't matter 1% whether he or Sujah rules in Kabul. We shall be secured by this. Let them fight among themselves as they will. It makes us all the stronger.
Akbar isn't to be trusted, Mac was beginning, but Macnaghten pooh-poohed him.
You don't know one of the first rules of politics, that a man can be trusted to follow his own interest. I see perfectly well that Akbar is after undisputed power among his own people. Well, who's to blame him? And I tell you, I believe you wrong, Akbar Khan. In our meetings, he has impressed me more than any other Afghan I have met. I judge him to be a man of his word.
The Duranis are probably saying that too, says I, and had the icy spectacles turned on me for my pains. But Mackenzie took me up fast enough, and asked me what I thought. I don't trust Akbar either, says I. Mind you, I like the chap, but he ain't straight. Flashman probably knows him better than we do, says Mac.
And Macnaghten exploded. Now, really, Captain Mackenzie, I believe I can trust my own judgment, do you know? Against even that of such a distinguished diplomatist as Mr. Flashman here.
He snorted and sat down at his desk.
I should be interested to hear precisely what Akbar Khan has to gain by treachery towards us. What purpose his proposal can have, other than that which is apparent? Well, can you tell me?
Mac just stubbed out his cheroot. If I could tell you, sir, if I could see a definite trick in all this, I'd be a happier man. Dealing with Afghans, it's what I don't see and don't understand that worries me.
Lunatic philosophy, says Macnaghten,
and wouldn't listen to another word. He was sold on Akbar's plan, plain enough, and so determined the next morning he had Mohammed and Hamet in and signified his acceptance in writing, which they were to take back to Akbar Khan. I thought that downright foolish, for it was concrete evidence of Macnaghten's part in what was, after all, a betrayal. One or two of his advisers tried to dissuade him from putting pen to paper, at least, but he wouldn't budge. Trouble is, the man's desperate, Mackenzie told me. Akbar's proposal came at just the right moment, when Macnaghten felt the last ray of hope was gone and he was going to have to skulk out of Kabul with his tail between his legs. He wants to believe Akbar's offer is above board. Well, young Fresh, I don't know about you, but when we go out to see Akbar tomorrow, I'm taking my guns along. I was feeling pretty nervous about it myself, and I wasn't cheered by the sight of Elfie Bay when Macnaghten took me along to see him that afternoon. The old fellow was lying on a daybed on his veranda while one of the garrison ladies, I forget who, was reading the scriptures to him. He couldn't have been more pleased to see me and was full of praise for my exploits, but he looked so old and wasted in his nightcap and gown that I thought, my God, what chance have we with this to command us? Macnaghten was pretty short with him, for when Elfie heard of Akbar's plan, he looked down in the mouth and asked if Macnaghten wasn't afraid of some treachery.
None at all, says Macnaghten. I wish you to have 2 regiments with 2 guns got ready, quickly and quietly, for the capture of Muhammad Khan's fort, where we shall meet Sirdar Akbar tomorrow morning. The rest you can leave to me.
Elfie looked unhappy about this. It's all very uncertain, says he, fretting.
I fear they're not to be trusted, you know. It is a very strange plot, to be sure.
Oh, my God, says Macnaghten. If you think so, then let us march out and fight them, and I'm sure we shall beat them.
I can't, my dear Sir William, says old Elfie, and it was pathetic to hear his quavering voice. The troops aren't to be counted on, you see.
Well, then we must accept the Sirdar's proposals. Elfie fretted some more, and Macnaghten was nearly beside himself with impatience. Finally he snapped out, I understand these things better than you, and turned on his heel and stamped off the veranda.
Elfie was much distressed and lamented on about the sad state of affairs and the lack of agreement.
I suppose he's right, and he does understand better than I, at least I hope so.
But you must take care, Flashman. All of you must take care.
Between him and McNaughton, I felt pretty down. But evening brought my spirits up, for I went to Lady Sale's house, where there was quite a gathering of the garrison and wives, and found I was something of a lion. Mackenzie had told my story, and they were all over me. Even Lady Sale, a vinegary old dragon with a tongue like a carving knife, was civil.
"Captain Mackenzie has given us a remarkable account of your adventures," says she. "You must be very tired. Come and sit here by me."
I pooh-poohed the adventures, of course, but was told to hold my tongue.
"We have little enough to our credit," says Lady Sale, "so we must make the most of what we have. You at least have behaved with courage and common sense, which is more than can be said for some older heads amongst us."
She meant poor old Elfie, of course, and she and the other ladies lost no time in taking his character to pieces. They did not think much of McNaughton either, and I was surprised at the viciousness of their opinions. It was only later that I understood that they were really frightened women. They had cause to be. However, everyone seemed to enjoy slanging Elfie and the envoy, and it was quite a jolly party. I left about midnight. It was snowing, and bright moonlight, and as I walked to my billet I found myself thinking of Christmas time in England, and the coach ride back from Rugby when the half ended, and warm brandy punch in the hall, and the roaring fire in the dining-room grate with Father and his cronies talking and laughing and warming their backsides. I wished I was there with my young wife, and at the thought of her my innards tightened. By God, I hadn't had a woman in weeks, and there was nothing to be had in the cantonments. That was something I would speedily put right after we'd finished our business with Akbar in the morning, and things were back to normal. Perhaps it was reaction from listening to those whining females, but it seemed to me as I went to sleep that McNaughton was probably right, and our plot with Akbar was all for the best. I was up before dawn, dressed in my Afghan clothes. It was easier to hide a brace of pistols beneath them than in a uniform. I buckled on my sword and rode over to the gate where McNaughton and Mackenzie were already waiting with a few native troopers. McNaughton, in his frock coat and top hat, was sitting a mule and damning the eyes of a Bombay cavalry cornet. It seemed the escort was not ready, and Brigadier Shelton had not yet assembled the troops who were to overpower the Durranis.
"You may tell the Brigadier there is never anything ready or right where he is concerned," McNaughton was saying. "It is all of a piece. We are surrounded by military incompetence. Well, it won't do. I shall go out to the meeting, and Shelton must have his troops ready to advance within the half-hour. Must, I say. Is that understood?"
The cornet scuttled off, and McNaughton blew his nose and swore to Mackenzie he would wait no longer. Mac urged him to hold on at least till there was some sign that Shelton was moving. But McNaughton said,
"Oh, he's probably in his bed still. But I've sent word to Legate. He will see the thing attended to. Ah, here are Trevor and Lawrence. Now, gentlemen, there's been time enough wasted. Forward."
I didn't like this. The plan had been that Akbar and the chiefs, including the Durranis, should be assembled near Mohammed's fort, which was less than a quarter of a mile from the cantonment gates. Once McNaughton and Akbar had greeted each other, Shelton was to emerge from the cantonment at speed, and the Durranis would be surrounded and overcome between our troops and the other chiefs. But Shelton wasn't ready. We didn't even have an escort, and it seemed to me that the five of us and the native troopers, who were only half a dozen or so strong, might have an uncomfortable time before Shelton came on the scene. Young Lawrence thought so too, for he asked McNaughton, as we trotted through the gate, if it would not be better to wait. McNaughton snapped his head off and said we could simply talk to Akbar until Shelton emerged, when the thing would be done.
"Suppose there's treachery," said Lawrence. "We'd be better to have the troops ready to move at the signal." "I can't wait any longer," cries McNaughton, and he was shaking, but whether with fear or cold or excitement, I didn't know.
And I heard him mutter to Lawrence that he knew there might be treachery, but what could he do? We must just hope Akbar would keep faith with us. Anyway, McNaughton would rather risk his own life than be disgraced by scuttling hangdog out of Kabul.
"Success will save our honour," says he, "and make up for all the rest."
We rode out across the snowy meadow towards the canal. It was a sparkling, clear morning, bitterly cold. Kabul city lay straight ahead, grey and silent. To our left, Kabul River wound its oily way beneath the low banks, and beyond it the great Bala Hisar fort seemed to crouch like a watchdog over the white fields. We rode in silence now, our hooves crunching the snow. From the four in front of me, the white trails of breath rose over their shoulders. Everything was very quiet. We came to the canal bridge. and just beyond it was the slope running down from Mohammed's fort beside the river. The slope was dotted with Afghans. In the centre, where a blue Bukhara carpet was spread on the snow, was a knot of chieftains, with Akbar in their midst. Their followers waited at a distance, but I reckon there must be 50 men in view. Barukses, Gilzais, Duranis, yes, by God, and Ghazis. That was a nasty sight. We're mad, I thought, riding into this. Why, even if Shelton advances at the double, we could have our throats cut before he's halfway here. I looked back over my shoulder to the cantonment, but there was no sign of Shelton's soldiers. Mind you, at this stage that was just as well. We rode to the foot of the slope, and what I was shivering with was not the cold. Akbar rode down to meet us on a black charger, and himself very spruce in a steel back and breast like a cuirassier, with his spiked helmet wrapped about with a green turban. He was all smiles and called out greetings to Macnaghten. Sultan Jan and the chiefs behind were all looking as jovial as Father Christmas and nodding and bowing towards us. "This looks damned unhealthy," muttered Mackenzie. The chiefs were advancing straight to us, but the other Afghans on the slopes on either side seemed to me to be edging forward. I gulped down my fear, but there was nothing for it but to go on now. Akbar and Macnaghten had met and were shaking hands in the saddle. One of the native troopers had been leading a lovely little white mare, which he now took forward, and Macnaghten presented it to Akbar, who received it with delight. Seeing him so cheerful, I tried to tell myself it was all right. The plot was laid, Macnaghten knew what he was doing, I really had nothing to fear. The Afghans were round us now, anyway, but they seemed friendly enough still. Only Mackenzie showed by the cock of his head and his cold eye that he was ready to drop his hand on his pistol butt at the first sign of a false move. "Well, well," cries Akbar, "shall we dismount?" End of side 10.